So yes, today I want to explore, or begin to explore, this theme of spiritual death. And I'll be exploring that tonight, and tomorrow night, next Monday, and then the last 2 weeks of seminar I'll explore spiritual rebirth. So I find it much easier to think about these stages if I keep going back to the life of the Buddha. I think about 2 weeks ago I was talking about the life of the Buddha, and I've been following, perhaps without us noticing, the life of the Buddha as I've been going through. So the last time I think I talked about him, I imagined him leaving the palace on his white horse, Kantika. And then as I was talking about it, I was sort of imagining that, like you might in a film where you see a white horse just disappearing off into the dark. And I said, didn't I, that according to tradition, these devas, they're sort of like angels really, they came down and they put their hands where the hooves would have dropped onto the courtyard to quieten the hooves. Yeah. And I was saying that the devas appear in the Buddha's life story, as it were, I think this is a bit too sophisticated and modern in the pejorative sense, but let's just say for the moment, as it were, to indicate the universal significance of that moment. They always appear when something especially important is happening. So we left him leaving the palace, going into the dark with Chandaka, his charioteer. And what I want to do now is just sort of follow him just briefly, very briefly, up to the enlightenment. I want to then talk about the phases of that, which is actually, when I started to think about it, become a kind of recapping of the stage of positive emotion, and then I want to talk about moving towards the enlightened. So, according to tradition, Siddhartha rode through the night, and he got to the first dawn, he arrived at the Enoma River, which marked the boundary of his land, of his father's land. And again, all these things seem to me significant, that he arrived there at dawn. Arrived at a river which marked the boundary of his father's land. So I see that as being the boundary of ordinary conventional assumptions. Come in, Pam. The boundary of ordinary conventional assumptions, the kind of world that we're brought up to believe in, the kind of value systems that we're brought up to ascribe to unthinkingly, that Siddhartha got to the edge of those. Of course, we all get to the edge of those at times, and sometimes it's at times when we have very difficult experiences. We're suddenly shocked into seeing that we are in a conscribed world with all kinds of pressures, expectations, assumptions, prejudices, and so on, which we're actually limited by. Sometimes we get to the edge, don't we, and we see a little bit beyond the world of our fathers, as it were, the world of our fathers. But mostly, most of us, I'm afraid, we retreat back. I've known many, many people, you know, teaching here at the centre, who have, for instance, sometimes very strong spiritual experiences. I remember talking to somebody very many, many years ago, who just told me about the experience he'd had. And I just thought, well, that's a vision experience. You know, that's an experience of how things really are, and a moment of seeing how things really are, beyond the land of our fathers, beyond all that has made us, beyond all of our conventional assumptions, and so on. But I've never seen him since. And it's so easily that happens. People talk about very strong experiences, and I think, gosh, I wish I'd had that. But the question is whether you stay in spiritual life, whether you carry on the journey, because there's so much against it. There's so much in the world and in ourselves, in our own hearts, in my heart, that wants to go back, that wants to go back into ordinary life, both in our mind and in our heart and in the world. I feel this very strongly, and in a way I feel it more strongly now than I did when I was young. When I first came along to the Buddhist Centre, I was 25, and I was very, very, very messed up, very unhappy. And I really, the first time I came to this centre, I came to the Wednesday class, I was taught mindfulness of breathing, and I immediately knew I was a Buddhist, and that I always had been a Buddhist, and that I always would be a Buddhist. And it wasn't a strong experience, it was just, oh yes, that's what I am. I've been wondering what I am all this time. I hadn't even wondered, known that I was wondering what I am. But that's what I am. And of course, that perception of the Dharma, of the true Dharma, which is, I've never had to correct that perception, interestingly. I think I intuitively knew what Buddhism was in that moment. I couldn't have explained it, but I knew what it was, and I knew it was life's purpose. I knew that Buddhism was the lesson of life, if you see what I mean. And I knew that immediately, instinctively, without having to be told very much about it, just by learning the mindfulness of breathing. But of course, as well as that sort of vision seems too strong a word really, it was more like just a simple acknowledgement. As well as that, there was my own personal unhappiness, my own mixed-upness, my own chaotic life, that by that time had got quite fractured between being, incredibly sort of entertaining. I could be very entertaining, I still can occasionally. I'll try and bring some out if I can, sometimes it's not there. I'd go between being very entertaining and being very depressed, very, very unhappy indeed. And my life was very split between those two. So people knew me in one way and they didn't know me in another. I was very unintegrated to go back to that first great stage of spiritual life. I needed to integrate much, much, much more. And, you know, in the last 20, however many years, 25 years, something like that, I could do the maths, but it's not my strong point. In the last however many years, I have integrated myself to some degree, and I am much more emotionally positive than I was. So actually I find now the temptation to go back, as it were, stronger. Because in those days, frankly, I couldn't have had a successful relationship if I tried. I couldn't have been successful in the world if I tried. I was too chaotic, too messed up, too unable to motivate myself, unable to see things through because I wasn't integrated. I couldn't. I had all these great ideas. I remember cycling once in this mad kind of flurry of ideas, and I told my partner at the time, I said, oh, I've just had three ideas for a novel, you know. Never wrote it, of course. You know what I mean? But in those days, I'd have all these ideas, but I could never see them through because I wasn't integrated enough. It's only a little bit of me that had those ideas, and then next day they just evaporated. But now, because I am more integrated, I can have ideas and I can actually see them through. I can see them all the way through. So I could even be something of a success in a tiny, tiny little world of modern poetry. I am, even now, a little toe's worth of success, which is all terribly exciting. But it's also a new danger, because suddenly I could be a success, but suddenly I could live with a partner, for instance, which I couldn't have done when I was younger. I would have frankly strangled him, and that would have been very bad indeed. I actually wasn't strong enough, but anyway, I could have tried. So strangely, I find myself in a place where actually I'm more fitted to the world, if you see me. So the world in a way gets more dangerous. When you're unhappy, it's quite good in a way, because it makes you push against the world. And when I was very young, I was very, very unhappy, and I just wanted to destroy the world, really. I come from a small town, and I wanted to destroy it. I thought that everyone was lying. I wanted to destroy it. I had a kind of rage about it. And as you get older, if you're not careful, you lose that rage. And you shouldn't lose it all. You shouldn't lose it all. It's very, very common, isn't it, for people, as they get older, to get less and less radical, less and less alive, really. They just become... Anyway, never mind. I'm going on about this, so I haven't even got to the story yet! I can do it, it's great. I completely go off. Actually, that it all comes from this thing that we sort of see beyond to the limit of the world, but we easily want to step back. And it's not just when you start, as you go on to spiritual life more and more, in a certain sense, there's greater and greater urges to just fall back into a conventional life, a conventional mindset, even a sort of spiritual conventional mindset, which is just as bad as any conventional mindset, really. It's just words. You end up with words, with nice-sounding spiritual words, which everybody thinks is lovely and so on, but they're just words. In Zen, they call it mouth Zen, which is a very good... But we want to follow this journey further, so then Siddhartha, he cuts off his hair. He has long blue-black hair, which is a sign in those days of being a prince. And he cuts off his hair. Interestingly, the Devas appear again, and they appear to gather the hair. It's lovely. You often see pictures. Well, I don't know how often. What pictures are you looking at? It wasn't in Lincoln's. Anyway, if you look at Buddhist pictures, occasionally you'll see one of these pictures of the Devas collecting the hair of... he's cutting his hair off usually with a sword. But again, I think it's significant they appear there because what it's saying there, I think, is that Siddhartha's not just leaving behind the conventional world of the palace. He's leaving behind the conventional world in him. He's leaving behind all kind of social status. I mean, cutting his hair off is a sign of leaving behind all status. Status in human beings goes very, very deep indeed. He's leaving behind the instinct to be someone. He's leaving behind being somebody in the eyes of others. He's leaving behind being a someone. At the moment he cuts his hair, he's no longer a someone. He's no one's son. He's not a prince anymore. He's not going to be a great ruler. He's a nobody. Yeah? So cutting his hair like that in that day meant, I'm now just a nobody. And it's interesting that it's then again that the Devas appear to gather the hair. Because that's the real going forth, is to go forth from the conventional in us. It goes so very, very deep. In a way, it's incredible that anyone could ever do it. And then what happens is there's a passing beggar, and he exchanges his clothes for the beggar's rags. So his clothes are very often a symbol, and they still are just as much for us as now as they were for Siddhartha then. They're a symbol of our social standing, of our wealth, of our prestige. The royal family are extremely careful. It's extremely important how they're dressed. Remember what happened when Princess Di, when she got married, stepped out of the carriage. Everybody wanted to see the dress. And it's partly because it tries to say this is who the person is. Actually, what happens, of course, is you just become the dress. But what the dress was trying to do was say this is a very important person because look how big the dress is. Or look how gorgeous the suit is. So Siddhartha swaps his princely clothes for the robes of a beggar. And then he walks up, then he goes off, and he walks off. I imagine him just walking into the forest alone. And according to tradition, he strokes his horse, his Kantika, for one last time, and he tells Chandaka to take the horse back to the palace. Ethan was telling me that according to some traditions, the horse died of a broken heart when it got back to the palace, not having Siddhartha. Interesting, I think there's even something in the horse that what happens is that it's trying to say, I think symbolically, that Siddhartha is completely in touch, in tune with nature, with the nature of the horse, with nature in him. He leaves it all behind, walks into the forest. And then to cut a fairly long story short, I just want to tell you one or two things that happened. So it's one lovely part of the sutra where he talks about just walking up and down and getting terrified. Absolutely terrified. He's here. You just remember, this is a young prince who's had a very, very pampered life. Suddenly he's cut off all his hair. He's wearing rags. He's on his own in this jungle. And the Indian jungle is a terrifying, terrifying place. And he'd walk up and down. He'd just hear... a twig break. I had that awful fear that it could be a tiger, because of course it could be a tiger. This terrible fear, you know, if anyone's experienced fear, and that awful uprising of fear, I'm sure we all have. And he said that if he was walking, he'd just carry on walking. If he was sitting in meditation, he'd just carry on sitting in meditation. if he was lying down, he'd just carry on lying down. He wouldn't do anything about it. He'd just feel this fear coursing through his body. And it's interesting. And again, you know, you get little tiny snippets that really sound like somebody saying, this is what it was like for me. Another sutra he says, oh yeah, and then I had to go and collect alms. So in those days you could just go around with a bowl and stand at people's doors and they'd open the door and they'd just give you whatever food they fancy and they'd just put it all in the bowl. Anything, you know, everything all mixed up together. And he said the first time he ate it, he found it so disgusting he vomited. You know, because it was everything. All the things you wouldn't mix together, all just mixed together like someone putting ice cream and dal in your bowl. And then you're really hungry and you eat that and you just said he just vomited, it was so disgusting. Yeah. That feels very authentic to me. When you read that, you think, oh yes, that's somebody saying, this is what it was like for me. I was a young prince, remember, and I'd never had to eat food like this. According to tradition, he then trained under two different teachers. He trained in meditation under two different teachers. There's a whole kind of, at that time, there's a whole kind of, all these different movements, spiritual movements, all teaching different things under different teachers. All of them, well, many of them, most of them practicing meditating. Meditation was very strongly practiced, and he learned from two sort of great meditation masters. According to tradition, he learned everything they could teach, and he came to embody everything they could teach. There's lovely little things in situ where the teachers say, actually, that's it. You've kind of done it. Everything I can teach you, I've taught you and you've experienced. So the first one says, so why don't we run this group together? Because actually your experience now is the same as mine. So how about we run this wee group together? And Siddhartha just says, no. Obviously it's interesting because he must have experienced these incredibly deep meditations in this time. Which is, I think, an interesting aside on the nature of meditation. That you can experience incredibly deep meditation and it's nothing to do with the Dharma. Because the Buddha just said, yeah, it was great, but no, it's not it. He must have had this incredible unwillingness to settle for anything but the real thing. He just seemed to have known instinctively, well, just not it. Even though it was really beautiful, I had these incredibly deep experiences, blissful experiences, ecstatic experience, it's not actually it. It's not it. I don't know what, possibly he couldn't say, just a, don't know why. Just doesn't do it. It doesn't solve the problem. And of course, remember, the problem is the problem of old age, sickness and death. That's the problem. The problem that life bequeaths us with. The problem that we're born with. Human life, right at its centre, has got the great problem. And Siddhartha was setting out to solve that problem. And he knew in this first meditation, it didn't solve that problem. He then went on to another meditation teacher, and according to this tradition, he then again perfects what this other meditation teacher teaches. And this other meditation teacher is just saying, well, actually, I think you've got a deeper understanding of this than I have. I think you've gone beyond me. Which is actually remarkable in itself. Very few people are able to do that, to admit that other people surpass them, especially people they first taught. Excuse me. If you're not careful, you're too keen to overtop people all the time. But here's a teacher who's very remarkable. You said, yeah, actually, I think you surpassed me. What I want to do is just give this group to you, because I think you're the teacher now. Actually, very impressive. Both men are obviously very impressive men in their own right. And Siddhartha again just says, no, it's just not it. Yes, I've experienced everything you taught me, but it's not it. It's not the solution. So he leaves them, and he goes off again wandering. And according to tradition, he starves himself. In those days, as still is the case in India, there was a very deep assumption that the way to release the spirit was to punish the body. It's sort of an idea in religious practice pretty much the world over, that you need to chastise the body to release the spirit. And again, what Siddhartha did, he's a very incredible man, so he just did it more than anybody else. Some of the writing about this is fairly gruesome, and I slightly wonder about it. It feels not quite right to me. I sang Ratchet to my own teacher. There's some Buddhist ideas of hells, and sang Ratchet just won't. Well, he just says no, we won't look at that. He thinks it's not really it. He thinks it's sort of rather anyway, then my ills have slightly warped people's imagination later on, if you mean. But let's just say that Siddhartha, he went as far as he possibly could with asceticism. He ate as little as possible. He forcibly subdued the body. It's interesting if you compare that with the white stallion as he leaves. You see, in a way, there is, I think, a nature theme about the body there, that he leaves on the white stallion, and now he tries to forcibly suppress that. He tries to forcibly suppress his own nature. And he does that more thoroughgoingly than anyone else. And he becomes well known for it. You know, he becomes a kind of ascetic celebrity, which is mean. He's revered for it, because there he is, going further than anybody else, and he gathers a little bunch of disciples. And one day, he faints, and he falls over, and he sort of rolls down this bank, almost into this river. And this is after years of practice. I think it's traditionally 7 years, which again is a mystic number, isn't it? He rolls in, he almost drowns, and then he sort of gets himself up and just thinks, this is getting me nowhere. This is getting me nowhere. I've been doing this for 7 years. I'm nearly dead. I'm no nearer. I'm no nearer to the solution. This is actually an incredible moment in the Buddha's biography. He's the world teacher who could admit that that was a waste of time. That didn't get me anywhere. That 7 years, that wasn't it. That didn't really do it. That didn't get me anywhere. It's a remarkable thing to do, is it? A great human achievement for us to be able to acknowledge that wasn't it, actually. That was a mistake, that. And what he did, he then started to eat. They always say he ate milk rice, which basically is milk rice pudding. Well, that sounds a bit funny when you say he ate rice pudding, so they always say milk rice. And he ate some rice pudding. ambrosia. And he ate some rice pudding, and as soon as that happened, his disciples left him. They were disgusted by him. They said that he'd reverted to luxury. You can imagine that. It's interesting that, because they must have had a brewing resentment to him all the time, that he was a prince, and people are a bit suspicious of people like princes. You think, oh yeah, whatever. You know, come a moment, he'll be back to the palace if he brings Jack Robinson. You know, so all he has to do is have some rice pudding. They think, ah, there you go, I told you. You know, he's reverted to luxury. What did I say? They're all the same, these princes. You know, a few hard days and they're back to the palace. Okay. So they all left him. Yeah. So there he was, alone again. Yeah, alone again. And then he basically just sort of gets himself well. And then he has this memory. Again, I think there's something very important about memory that we need to sort of think about more. For me, there's a crossover between memory and myth. So he has this memory, and he remembers when he was 8. And he remembers watching his father plough. And there's all kinds of different versions of it, but let's keep it really simple. He's sitting under a tree, he's watching his father plough. And when he remembers it, he remembers that he was incredibly happy. Incredibly happy. But what he remembers is that happiness was nothing to do with craving. He didn't want anything. There was pleasure, but it wasn't to do with wanting anything. He was just completely happy, completely content. And in the mythic stories about it, the shadow of the tree that he was sitting in doesn't move all day. Fantastic image, isn't it? Basically, it's an image that time stood still. Yeah. So he sat there and he remembered that time when he was 8, when time seemed to stand still. Of course, it stood still because he didn't want anything. As soon as you don't want anything, what happens? So as we're sitting here just now, if we don't want anything, if you don't want me to hurry up and finish, if you don't want to hurry up and go home, if you don't want to even including not want things, if we didn't want or not want something, what would happen to time? You know what I mean? If we didn't want anything at all, if we didn't not want anything, what would happen to time? The tree above us would stay completely still, as it were. Yeah? So he just remembers this experience when time seemed to stop. And he knows immediately that that's the answer, that there's something in that that is the way. Which is interesting, again, because he's had all these meditation experiences, but there's something about this that's particular. And it must, it's interesting, this eight, so it's got this particular innocence, a lack of sophistication, perhaps even a lack of technique, or a lack of being preoccupied by technique. I don't know, I'm just playing with the thought. It's something natural. He wasn't trying to meditate, he wasn't trying to learn stages and whatever. He suddenly discovered something very completely natural, so natural that an 8-year-old could do it. Yeah. And it was this pleasure with no grasping, no craving, no urge in it, no hankering. So he knew that there was something in that that was absolutely vital. So then he famously took himself off, sat under a peepal tree, and he made his great vow that whatever happens, I will not move from this place until I gain enlightenment. He says, flesh can wither from my body, blood can dry up, but I will not move from this space until I've gained enlightenment. This is where, if necessary, I will die here. And then he sits. Yeah. I want to leave the story there for a moment. And really, I just want to explore that story and what it tells us about these great stages of the spiritual life. So we left him, as I said, going into the dark, and then cuts his hair off. So it's striking this. So I think you could think of this period between leaving the palace and making that great vow as the stage of positive emotion. So the point up to leaving the palace itself on the horse, on Kantaka, is the stage of integration. Because remember, he really sees old age, sickness, and death. And the reason we don't see it is because we're not all here. Because we're not here, body, soul, and guts, and heart. When we see old age, sickness, and death, we don't really see it. We're not integrated, we're not collected, we're not whole. So we don't see things whole. We don't see things completely. We just see with a bit of ourselves. So that great seeing, those three great sights and the fourth sight of the wandering holy man, is an image for the deepest possible integration. So that to see is to know. There's no difference between perception and feeling, intellect and heart. There is just a whole person wholly attending, as D.H. Lawrence said. But this movement beyond the palace is a movement of positive emotion. And I think it's very important to stress that it's a movement beyond the palace. And that palace, as I said before, is a palace of being me. It's the walled citadel of ourself. It's the me that I'm attached to, including the negative me that I'm attached to, our bad habits that we can be just as attached to, just as identified with, sometimes even more identified with, than our qualities. We nurse ourselves in them. We nurse our grudges sometimes, don't we? We nurse our pain. I say we, and I include myself. I've just been seeing myself doing it today, how I can nurse my own pain. Yeah? Very, very easy to do. You're sort of weird, really, because it hurts you, and yet you sort of do it. You sort of want to go back to it. You want to fiddle with that loose tooth to see whether it still hurts. Yeah? So he goes beyond all that. I think perhaps particularly those self-confirming, self-justifying stories that we tell about ourselves. Those sob stories, those who but me stories, those I'm fantastic stories, all of that. And interestingly, one of the things he has to do is he has to face fear. So the stage of positive emotion is a stage of facing fear, facing up to fear, not letting fear push us back into the palace. Most of us, as soon as we have a fear, we're back across that river. We're back into the land of our fathers. And we're back home. Children are like that, aren't they? They get fear. The first thing they do is they run back to their mother or their father. It's very, very natural, but it always limits us. As soon as we get frightened, we want to go back into the known. And so the positive emotion is about being with fear. It's interesting, as soon as you think of it like that, this whole idea of positive emotions is vastly expanded, isn't it? And this is what I think Buddhism means by positive emotion. But then the next thing he does is he learns. He learns, doesn't he? He goes. He doesn't just think, "Tell you what, I've left the palace. I'm on a search here. I'm going to do it my way." He goes and learns. He seeks. He must have sought those teachers. They can't come to him. He would have sought the teachers, and he learns. And he learns incredibly, doesn't he? He learns absolutely. He learns everything they have to teach him. And that means that he's not proud. I think I've talked about this before, but one of my great artistic heroes is Raphael, Renaissance painter. When he was young, he wasn't a great painter at all. In fact, his early paintings are sort of quite poor, you know, by Renaissance standards. Try it yourself, you know. do one at home. But what you see is that he happened to be around at the right place at the right time. So he was in Florence when Michelangelo and Leonardo was there, and he learned everything from them. So much so that Michelangelo hated him because he thought he'd nicked all of his ideas, which he had. But he's in the artistic world, he's a brilliant image for learning, just being willing to learn without saying, "Yes, but I want to do it my way. Yes, but I need to find my own voice. I need to be a painter in my own right here. It's all very well, but you're the big people. It's my turn." There obviously can't have been any of that. He just took it all in. He does one painting when he was young that basically you can hardly tell whether it's him or Michelangelo. He just takes the whole thing in, utterly unthreatened. That's a fantastic thing if we could learn, isn't it? Just to learn without this dreadful self keep on feeling threatened, keep on rising up and saying, "Oh no, I want this talk to be my talk. I don't want you to tell me what I can say because then it won't be my talk anymore. So I want it to be my talk." You see what I mean? Fantastic thing, just to learn. So positive emotion is about learning, about being willing to learn and being willing to put egoism aside to learn. So putting, "Yes, but my voice, my special thing, my particular take on things, never mind all that, how about we learn, yeah? We just learn everything that we could be taught, and then we can come to what's my own particular contribution." And then the next thing that happens, of course, is he has this experience of vomiting. And I want to link this with this experience later on, where he starves himself. So what that's saying is, the stage of positive emotion means you need to be willing to face discomfort. You need to be willing to embrace discomfort. You can't live in comfort and live a spiritual life. In fact, spiritual life will bring discomfort to you. Yes, the Dharma, the spiritual life, the journey, as I want to call it, will help you with your stress, it will help you become happier. It's definitely helped me in that way. I'm much, much happier than I ever was. I don't know what would have become of me if I had not come to this Buddhist centre 25 years ago. I may not be alive, I think. I told this Banti recently, he said, "Oh yes, doesn't bear thinking about." So, you know, I don't know what would happen to me. It definitely made me happier, much more fulfilled than I ever would have dreamt. I have better friends now than I ever had, even as a child. And it's very, very rare for somebody of my age to be able to say that, especially a man, I think. So I've been heaped with fortune in my spiritual life, but I've also attracted things to me that I do not want. So I've attracted much more, I know it's hard to believe, much more antagonism. I've had many, many more people criticise me than I would have done otherwise. I've attracted difficult experiences. I've attracted situations where I've had to face my fears and get into an argument with someone, which, frankly, I would have run a mile from when I was young. I never had arguments with people. I used to just resent them. I did the English way of hatred, which is never to tell anybody when the door is closed. But none of your friends need ever know. It's been perfected for generations of English. And I could have managed that. And of course what happens is you do that and then you drink to let off steam. As a way of getting away from your critical faculty. One of the things you notice as you practice spiritual life is your critical faculty, which you've tried to erase because it doesn't seem nice, suddenly rears up and you can no longer subdue it. Smiling there, but So spiritual life brings trouble. If you don't want trouble, don't do it. Really, it brings a sort of a different kind of trouble, because it brings trouble that actually can help you grow. But it will bring trouble, especially if you go, if you're serious about it. If you're not serious about it, it won't bring you very much trouble. If you are, the more serious about it, it will bring you trouble. Because you'll start to think, I need to say, there'll be a situation where people are saying something, and you'll think, I need to speak out. I need to actually say, excuse me, I don't agree, or something. Or you'll find that you're with a friend and you'll have to say, do you know what? I think there's something for you in this as well. You know, you're saying how much your boss is terrible and how they're always overworking you, but actually I kind of understand what they're getting at. I think there is something. You know, you'll want to find a really nice way of putting it, but you'll find it very increasingly difficult not to enter into that. So if you don't want to, leave now. So spiritual life attracts trouble, and Siddhartha attracted trouble. He was able to bear discomfort. But also what it shows you is that it also attracts possible success, which is interesting, isn't it? So Siddhartha actually could have been successful, spiritually successful, but that isn't important. He could have been successful. As you practice, you could become more successful. You can start to seem really rather special, and rather charismatic, and even rather spiritual, or just successful. Because you're more integrated, because you're more positive, because you can take more initiative, you're more likely to be successful. And that success creates dangers. It means that you're more likely, to settle down into those success. So spiritual positivity, genuine emotional positivity, means not settling for worldly success, including worldly spiritual success. At the moment, there's a whole smorgasbord of spiritual teachers. You can go online, non-aligned spiritual teachers who often are, they say something like, I'm very indebted to Buddhism, or, I've taken from Buddhism, but of course, I'm not a Buddhist, or I'm not part of a particular spiritual movement. It's very, very common at the moment. It seems to be part of our historical moment. Siddhartha wouldn't have done that, because it's just spiritual success. So there's new dangers of success. So real positive emotion is not falling for that, not falling for success. Actually very, very difficult. And so much so that even when he does something like he starves himself, he doesn't just think, actually, I'm onto a good one here because I've got a whole band of disciples. I've got a coterie, basically. I'll just stick with this. Actually, not getting anywhere, but people seem to really like me for it, so we'll stick with that. Very, very tempting as you live to live up to what people want from you. People want you to be funny. You end up, like me, just doing that. Not because you feel like it sometimes, but just because you're frightened to separate yourself from the group, if you see what I mean. People want you to be serious all the time or something. Very, very difficult not to just mirror the expectations of those around you, especially if you have a coterie. Generally quite bad for people to end up with a coterie. So I think all of that wonderfully, I must write about it actually because I haven't, but I think all of that wonderfully tells us in much more detail what Buddhism means by positive emotion. And it's not what the words mean quite, is it? It's not what we expect positive emotion to mean. It's something actually much more risky. It's something much more, it's got much more air in it. It's life with the window open, in fact all the windows open. But then, just to finally get onto the subject of the night, then he makes this great vow. He then, on the basis of all of that, says, flesh may wither up, blood may dry, but I will not move from this spot until I gain enlightenment. The great vow. And I was on the symphony, it occurred to me that I think probably this is word for word. This is probably, I think there's two moments in the Buddha's life which I think, it's my little theory, is that it's literally what he said, or literally what he thought. Because if you were Siddhartha, and you had in that moment made a decision, and you look back on it, you'd probably be able to remember exactly what you said to yourself, because he's saying that to himself with full integration and full positive emotion. He says, that's it, that's it, I'm going to stay here until I die if need be. I think it's very likely he could have said to his disciples later on in his life, after he's enlightened, I said to myself this. And I think it's very likely that his disciples remembered those words word for word. I think there's very few times that would be possible. But in these moments, I think it's really very likely that people would remember them. It's interesting what we remember, isn't it? We remember something when it's at its most condensed and it's at the pinnacle of integration and positive emotion. We remember key things, if you see what I mean. So I think it's very likely that people remember what Siddhartha said. So there's like that, there's literally that little thought has travelled 2,500 years towards us. Yeah. And of course he couldn't have done that without all of that integration and all that positive emotion. So this is the moment of spiritual death. And interestingly he says, I will die here if not. It's either death or enlightenment. I'm not, that's it. I will stay here until I die, if necessary. I'm not moving until I gain enlightenment. So it's a thought of the greatest possible imaginative human magnitude. It's probably the most profound thought a human being could ever have. And it's a thought that we can't have because we're not integrated enough and because we're not positive enough. We could have it, but it wouldn't mean very much. Yeah? We'd be then thinking, actually, I'm a bit hungry. we'd be back to rice pudding before we can take that one. So this is a moment of spiritual death, and for tonight's purposes, next week, I want to step back from the story and I want to talk more kind of metaphysically, at least try to look at the laws of reality, and because I think that casts more light on spiritual death, and I think we have to do that at that moment. But for now, I want to think about this as the moment of commitment. Commitment in the deepest possible, deepest imaginable way. This is where the Buddha says, I am going to do this, and I'm not doing anything else. I'm going to gain enlightenment, or I'm going to die. It's the deepest possible human commitment to reality. I'm going to see things how they really are, or I'm going to die trying. Yeah? So this is the stage. Spiritual death is the stage of commitment, because when we commit, something has to die. Siddhartha's vow is spiritual death at its most. It's most remarkable. It's perfected, because he'll actually let himself die. You know, he'll say, "Okay, my life, I'll die then." For us, all the way back into our life, every time we make a commitment, we have to die. We have to then say, "Okay, I'm going to do this. I'm not going to do all these other things." As I was saying on my announcement, it's a death to add-ons. I can't just keep on adding on to my life. If I'm going to take this spiritual life seriously, I'm going to have to commit myself to it. Completely commit myself to it. I'm going to have to work out what that means. It's not as obvious as it sounds, but I'm going to have to commit myself to it. Otherwise, I'm not going to make much progress. And in the Sri Ratna tradition, it's at the moment of asking for ordination that symbolises that moment. It's at that moment you think, well, up to then it's, let me see whether I want to follow the Buddha or not. Let me just get to the edge of the lands of my father, and if it gets a bit uncomfortable, I can go back. I'm not sending Chanda off back with the horse. I'm not going to actually even swap my clothes for a beggar. But I am trying to be there. I'm trying to be following Siddhartha. But there comes a point in spiritual life where you have to think, I need to leave now. I need to cross the river, the Enoma River. I need to go beyond the land of my fathers. I need to go beyond myself now. I need to leave now. In my book, I've wanted to call it the archetype of departure, of leaving the world behind. And it really, that is the world in us behind. Yeah. So it's that moment of commitment where you think, actually, this is the heart of life. This is what's truly important in life. And it's truly important on the basis of old age, sickness and death. This is the only thing that's important when I stand my life up against those great figures of old age, sickness and death. This is the only thing in the world that still stands up. In the great wind of old age, sickness and death, only this quest stands up. Only this quest. And even this quest sometimes is a flickering, guttering flame, but only that flittering, guttering flame is real. So it's a stage of commitment. And I remember when I was ordained in the in Spain in the middle of a 4-month retreat, and the metaphor for ordination is going to the tiger's cave. And the tradition is that there are a set of footsteps going in and no set of footsteps coming out. It's a wonderful image. The ordination, commitment, the stage of spiritual death, you see how they all sit together metaphorically, is you see these footsteps going into a tiger's cave and no footsteps coming out. It's a moment, it's an incredibly important moment when you're ordained. And I remember the night before, they always say this, they say, okay, tomorrow you're going to be ordained, if you want to. It's up to you. You don't have to. If you want to get ordained tomorrow, you can get ordained tomorrow. That's what's going to happen. If you want to do it, yeah? And they said, there's a path from here to where you'll be ordained. I won't tell you where the path goes, I won't say anything about it, but there's a path, a rough path, not a nicely laid path. We're back into the land of metaphor again, but not a rough path, a hacked way. There's a path, and they'd say, and there's that road there, that, you know, that, so you can see the road just outside the shrine room, that goes all the way back down to Alicante. In fact, it goes pretty much to Benidorm, just the other side, on the side of the mountain. The road goes down there. And he said, now it's up to you. Which path do you want to go on? You can't do both. This is now the moment. Now you see how this moment doesn't appear until then, really. Up till then, we're always trying to practice both paths. We're trying to be in the world and move away from the world. At the point of ordination, you're trying to say, I'm going to choose this path, which actually means I'm going to try to dedicate my life to keep on choosing this path rather than that road. Excuse me. This hacked path that actually I don't really understand and nobody really understands, rather than this tarmacked way back to the world. Yeah. And on the night before my ordination, I thought, I want to take this seriously. I want to take it very, very seriously. I wanted to have as much of me ordained as possible. I didn't want it just to be another of my bright ideas. And I remember I sat on this rock and looked at the road going down to Benidorm. And actually at night, beautiful, it's dark, and all the stars come out, and you can see the glittering lights of Alicante, like little yellow lights glimmering in the distance, and they sparkle, you know, from a few miles away, but you can see them glittering in the distance. And I sat there and I could really feel, oh, I want to go home, I want to go back, I this is difficult, this life, this spiritual life, I want to go back, I want to go back to the world. The metaphor suddenly came alive to me that there was a road back to the world, and I was going to choose to commit myself to this other path that I didn't actually understand. I was walking to the tiger's cave. I didn't understand where I was going, and you never do. The reason I wanted to start this whole session on spiritual death in this personal way is because I wanted to go from experience into structure. I didn't want to start with metaphysics and say, see how it works out, because you don't know. Every time you commit yourself, you're always committing yourself to the unknown. You don't actually know what ordination means. You don't know what reality is. You don't know. All you're doing is you're following a hunch. And sometimes, frankly, you really wish you weren't. And that night, at times, I thought, why have I done this? What did I think? I was only joking. You know? I said, well, I don't take this so seriously, crikey. You know? I was just having experience. I just thought I'd be a spiritual person. I didn't really mean it. There's a weird way when you really realise you didn't really mean it. You know? So that is this stage for us. For wherever we find that, it's the stage of commitment. Next week I'll say more about the metaphysics, and I want to say more about how we actually practice this stage. But in a sense, at the moment I want to say you can't practice it. You have to decide to commit yourself or not. That's what this stage really means. It's not a practice, it's a decision. Next week I can say, I'll tell you what, it is a practice. But the more truthful thing is to say, it's a decision. I wanted to frighten us. I frightened myself. Okay, so let's just finish now by closing our eyes again. And I'd like to finish like we did last week. I'll start the Shakyamuni mantra. And this mantra evokes what happens after Siddhartha made that great vow. It evokes the love and compassion of Siddhartha. And what I'd like to do, like we did last week, we can carry on chanting, and you can sit here if you want to, and just gradually, quietly, when you're ready, put in your cushions and mats at the side, just chanting, and try and see whether we can do that with the chant, not in the spirit of us departing, that's what I mean. Every departure, even this small departure, has got a meaning. There's something about departure. We're always departing. And if you want to, you can come to the shrine and make an offering. There's some incense and there's tapers that you can just light. And in your own time, just chanting the mantra and letting and watching each other even depart. See that here we are together, and this moment never comes again. People always say that. Here we are now, and now we're going to leave it. This thing that we've created together, we're going to just depart now. And we're going to depart with the mantra. And then you can talk as soon as you've got out into the reception room.